necessarily belong, but are a contributor or leader. On the unhealthy end of the continuum is the insecure person who measures self-worth as a function of the approval of others and whose constant craving for social acceptance is a bottomless pit. Be aware that you can be blind to the impact of your payoff system. As in the scenario of the crying child, parents can inadvertently reward unhealthy, destructive behavior. The unfortunate fact is that the power of a payoff can support even behavior that you do not consciously want. For example, you may consciously be lonely and yearn for the social and psychological income that derives from participation and companionship with others. But the fear of rejection can be so powerful that the payoff of escaping that anxiety may override your desire to reach out. In this battle of the payoffs, the easier and more immediate payoff comes from simply staying at home and not participating. Sometimes one payoff prevails only because it is the path of least resistance. And not all payoffs are obvious. With a female patient I treated some years ago, I witnessed a pattern of behavior that was seemingly illogical and seemingly unwanted. In fact, without the insight provided by this life law, her behavior might have seemed downright bizarre. Karen was often 50 to 100 pounds overweight. She had the very frustrating pattern of losing weight only to gain it back. Sound familiar? She would tell me that she wanted desperately to lose the weight and keep it off. She recognized that the effect of the obesity was to alter her appearance dramatically and that it was just plain unhealthy. She could recite for me all the benefits and values of losing the weight and was very articulate about the good feelings and rewards she got from doing so. Nevertheless, after very effectively and efficiently losing up to 80% of the unwanted weight, Karen would invariably and seemingly without explanation begin to fail in her efforts. She would eventually gain all of it back. It was as if she sabotaged herself every time she approached her goal. I knew enough about payoffs to be convinced that Karen must be getting some kind of reward for this self-sabotage, so I began to dig as deeply as she would tolerate. Ultimately, I learned that Karen had been sexually molested as a child. As a consequence of that trauma and the unwanted attention and the feelings that her body had attracted, she had become uncomfortable and ashamed of her sexuality. The guilt and anxiety she felt when men took a sexual interest in her was profound. Once we discovered this, Karen and I began to see that gaining weight provided her with the safety of sexual irrelevancy. In other words, since male attention brought guilt, fear, and anxiety, she took refuge in gaining enough weight so that she felt her sexual attractiveness had been neutralized. Reflecting on it, Karen described her own behavior as zipping on a 100-pound snowsuit to hide her sexuality. Although that suit offered temporary comfort, Karen's guilt, anxiety, and fear would eventually diminish. When she had spent months without much attention, those feelings would be replaced by the loneliness and defeat she felt when she was morbidly obese. At that point, the vicious cycle of lose, gain, lose, gain would start all over. It was a war between the psychological income of feeling safe, free from the acute anxieties associated with male attention, and the transient but powerful feeling of accomplishment she got during the early stages of weight loss. Once Karen identified the psychological income derived from her self-sabotage, she was able to start dealing with the true problem. She broke the vicious cycle. Keep in mind that Karen's payoff system was rather subtle and complex. Payoffs can and often are much more simplistic. For example, there is a much larger group of obese people who overeat simply because of the pleasurable sensation of ingesting the food. It tastes good. For them, the sensory gratification of eating the food outweighs the enjoyment of being at their ideal body weight. Another element to consider in analyzing the payoffs in your life is the appeal of immediate versus delayed gratification. As a society, Americans are not very good at delaying their gratification. Fast food restaurants, convenience stores, and prepared foods all testify to the fact that we have conditioned ourselves to want what we want when we want it. Our demand for immediate gratification creates an appetite for a small payoff now rather than a large payoff later. I want you to realize that you may be so controlled by payoffs that you're being overwhelmed by them. As complex as the web of addictive payoffs can be, you do have a North Star to guide you, to keep you focused on what is really happening. The North Star that you must keep uppermost in your thinking is, regardless of the logic, if I am repeatedly doing whatever it is that I am doing, I am getting a payoff. I will not delude myself by thinking it is not so. If I search, I will find the payoff because it is there. I am not getting paid off for some of my patterns of behavior. I am getting paid off for all of my patterns of behavior every time. I am not an exception because there is no exception. Life law number 4. You can't change what you don't acknowledge. Your strategy? Get real with yourself about your life and everybody in it. Be truthful about what isn't working in your life. Stop making excuses and start making results. Perhaps this law, more than any other, seems self-evident. And to some degree, it is. If you're unwilling to acknowledge a thought, circumstance, problem, condition, behavior, or emotion, if you won't take ownership of your role in a situation, then you cannot and will not change it. Imagine your doctor asking you whether you've been having dizzy spells, and rather than admit it, you say, "Well, no, not really." What's going to happen? The doctor isn't going to address the problem, and you'll keep getting dizzy. He might treat your sore toe or the ache in your elbow, but because you have lied to him, he may never deal with the real underlying problem. Because the doctor assumes that you are motivated to get better, he trusts you to identify your problems for him so he'll know where to focus his efforts. You very likely believe that you can rely on yourself in a similar fashion. Just as the doctor depends on you to be honest with him, you depend on yourself to shoot straight with yourself. But as we just saw with life law number 3, you may have a competing agenda. If, by denying the existence of a problem, you reap benefits for avoiding a painful subject, that makes you anything but a reliable informant. If you hope to have a winning life strategy, you have to be honest about where your life is right now. The connection between knowing exactly, precisely where you are in your life right now and where you want your life to be should be obvious. Suppose you're out there, wandering around the United States, and you call me on the phone and ask, "How do I get to Toledo?" My first question is obviously going to be, "Well, where are you now?" Clearly, if you tell me you are in California, I'm going to give you directions very different from those I would give if I learned you were in South Carolina. The same holds true for the directions I might give to you for changing your life. If you reported, for example, that your marriage was absolutely wheels off and in a ditch, I would approach the situation differently than I would if you told me your marriage was doing fine. If you told me that you were in a quagmire of poor self-management mentally, emotionally, and physically, I would give very different directions for change than I would if you told me that you were self-disciplined and on top of your personal matters. Likewise, if you lie to yourself about any dimension of your life, you can distort the entire picture so much that an otherwise sound strategy will be compromised. You must be keenly aware that you can lie to yourself in two ways. You can affirmatively misrepresent the truth, or you can lie to yourself by omission. Failing to tell yourself what is just as dangerous as misrepresenting what is. So you have to have the strength and courage to ask yourself the hard questions and to give yourself realistic answers. You cannot afford the luxury of defensiveness, and you cannot afford the luxury of lies and denial. Denial, after all, is what kills dreams. It kills hope. Denial can, quite literally, kill you. I don't say that to be dramatic. I say it because it's true. In virtually every walk of life, I've seen the sad effects of denial, and I'll bet you have too. It's time to address the denial in your own life. Let's begin by recognizing that in all humans, there's a seldom discussed self-protective mechanism that behavioral scientists commonly refer to as perceptual defense. Perceptual defense is a mechanism that protects us from those things that our minds, at some level, determine that we cannot handle or which we do not want to face. But, as in most things in life, it's got two sides. Perceptual defense does not always work to the good. It can and does keep you from seeing things you simply don't want to be true. In a number of situations, it may prevent your picking up warning signs that, if you acknowledge them, could prompt you to take important and timely coping steps. Perhaps this mechanism keeps you from recognizing that you're falling out of favor with your boss. Maybe it blinds you to the deterioration in your most important relationship, thus allowing further distance and damage to occur. Perceptual defense can keep you from recognizing the warning signs of a serious disease that, if detected and treated early, could be contained or cured. It can keep you from seeing the warning signs of any number of negative behaviors in your children, such as depression, drug or alcohol abuse, or a general alienation from the world. It's a human tendency found in every walk of life. We do not want problems to be true. We do not want bad news. And as a result, we become functionally blind to signals that are practically shouting at us. A twice married woman, determined that her second marriage will be nothing like the first, denies to herself that the identical patterns of conflict are beginning to occur in this one. A husband and father, proud of his standing in the community and determined to maintain the appearance of a happy family, insists to himself that all is well, even though every other member of the family is in counseling. By refusing to acknowledge that you are out of control, that things are not as they should be, you let valuable time slip away, and with it, precious options expire. Your life is not too bad to fix, and it's not too late to fix it. But be honest about what needs fixing. Being honest means taking off the rose-colored glasses and seeing the world and your life clearly. That may mean recognizing critical and immediate threats that loom on your horizon, or identifying the slow leaks that may be draining away your hopes and dreams. Maybe the truth you must embrace pertains to others in your life, but maybe the truth has more to do with you. If at this point in your life you're living like a lazy slug, admit it. If you're bitter and hostile, admit it. If you're scared, admit it. Be honest, or you will cheat yourself out of what may be the best chance you've ever had to escape the shadows of your current life and get what you really want. Not surprisingly, we find it much easier to see this law at work in the lives of other people. Why can't they see how they're messing up, right? There's a useful illustration in alcoholism. Almost everyone in our society has knowledge of alcoholism. You may be an alcoholic, know an alcoholic, or have at some time had a relationship with an alcoholic, whether friend or family member. Based on that familiarity, how would you assess the chances of an alcoholic's ever overcoming his or her drinking problem without first acknowledging that a problem did in fact exist? If you put those chances roughly at zero, I'd say your estimate may be a little too optimistic. If they don't face it, they will never replace it. The same necessity for acknowledgement applies to you as well. If you're unwilling or unable to identify and consciously acknowledge your negative behaviors, characteristics, or life patterns, then you will not change them, any more than will the alcoholic who lives in denial. Period. End of story. What is it that I want you to acknowledge? I want you to acknowledge whatever is not working in your life. Self, marriage, career, attitude, anger, depression, fear, whatever is not working. As I've said, I don't care if you are absolutely, no doubt, drop-dead certain that what you are doing is right. If it is not working, then change it. We need to talk very candidly about what I mean when I say acknowledge. I'm not talking about lip service or a simple nod of acknowledgement, lacking any real conviction or commitment to change. Acknowledgement is a no-kidding, unvarnished, bottom-line, truthful confrontation with yourself about what you are doing or not doing, or what you are putting up with in your life that is destructive. Bottom line, acknowledgement means dealing with the truth. Really dealing with the truth. If you accept the premise that people are by nature hedonistic, that is, that we seek pleasure and avoid pain, then you will recognize that it's not easy to deal with the truth, and it's not easy to change it. In order to stay comfortable, you must maintain the status quo, since movement can be scary, risky, and demanding. There's something very threatening about acknowledging a problem. It can create a lot of pressure. It's a kind of self-indictment. As long as you never admit your life isn't working, you can just go along getting along. But once you do admit something is not working, you're also forced to admit that you're selling out for what you don't want. Once you have acknowledged the existence of a problem and your ownership of it, living with the status quo becomes much more difficult. You have broken through your delusional system. Now you have to consciously self-destruct or change. Once you admit ownership of the problem, you cannot hide behind other people. Remember, there are no accidents. You create your own experience by what you choose and do. Lying to yourself by omission is not a good way to begin to change. In order to incorporate this law into your life strategy, you need to come fully to grips with the concept of honesty in general and with self-honesty in particular. Honesty means the truth, the whole truth, the unvarnished, ugly truth. It takes courage and commitment to be brutally, genuinely honest with yourself. As you take up this opportunity to create a strategy for your life, make a deal with yourself right now. There will be no lies, no excuses, and no conning yourself about what is going on. This is not the time to cheat yourself with mamby-pamby self-evaluation, telling yourself what you want to be true as opposed to what is. You have to be willing to ask yourself the hard questions and give yourself brutally honest answers. I have long believed that 50% of the solution to any problem lies in defining the problem. Once you've had the courage and commitment to lay it out to yourself exactly as it is, then you cannot and will not spend another day in fantasy. But it takes nothing short of that. For example, if you're trying to assess why you are failing to achieve a certain goal, you must not give yourself the benefit of the doubt. You mustn't allow yourself excuses. You must live and think by the life laws that we have covered so far. Specifically, you must acknowledge that whatever your circumstance It did not happen by accident. No excuses. You own it. You created it. You must acknowledge that you have to gain knowledge if you want the power to change. You must acknowledge that you're getting some kind of payoff for living with what you don't want, and you must be willing, honestly, to acknowledge and label whatever personal characteristics are keeping you from success. If you are scared, then you must say, "I am scared." If you are confused, admit it. Consider how refreshing it would be to wake up tomorrow and honestly be able to say, "For the first time in my life, I am not lying to myself. For the first time in my life, I am facing the honest truth." The price of poker is going way up when we start acknowledging the truth about ourselves. You can be half-hearted here and tell yourself part of the truth, but if you really want to change, don't do it halfway. That dog won't hunt. Not even close. Part of the challenge here is accepting that there is something in each and every one of us that is not pretty, not courageous, and not appealing. It is that part of us that makes us compromise. It is that part that causes us to work at cross purposes with our healthy goals. I'm not trying to drag you down. I'm trying to make you be real. Face it so you can replace it. You have to give yourself permission to be less than perfect. You have to give yourself permission to have accumulated baggage, distorted thoughts, feelings, and emotions, without condemning yourself as a bad person. Affecting meaningful and lasting change in our lives, even under the best of circumstances, is difficult enough. Don't add to the difficulty by being naive or gullible in assessing what's really happening in your life. You mustn't be duped by your own self-talk any more than when you listen to other people. If this program is going to meet you where you are, then you'll have to be honest about where that is. You'll have to get real. Life law number 5. Life rewards action. Your strategy? Make careful decisions and then pull the trigger. Learn that the world couldn't care less about thoughts without actions. The responses and results that you receive from anyone in any situation are triggered by the stimuli you provide. The stimuli are your behaviors. This is the only way people can get to know you and decide whether to reward or punish you. If you behave in a purposeless, meaningless, unconstructive way, you get inferior results. If you behave in a purposeful, meaningful, constructive way, you get superior results. That is how you create your own experience. When you choose the behavior, the action, you choose the consequences. The better the choices, the better the results. The better the behavior, the better the results. But the bottom line is, if you do nothing, you get neither. Life rewards action. People don't care about your intentions. They care about what you do. The IRS doesn't care if you meant to pay your taxes. Your child doesn't care if you meant to fix dinner. The people in the crosswalk are not at all comforted that you meant to stop. What matters, what determines the script of your life, is what you do. Start by committing to measure your life and its quality based on results, not intentions. It's been said that the road to hell is paved with good intentions. I take that to mean that good intentions without actions will lead you nowhere but down. Yet your natural tendency, whether you want to admit it or not, is to make excuses. Your natural tendency is to give yourself permission to say what you want to do or intend to do, but then fall way short of doing it. It is the human way. You didn't invent this method, but in a society of procrastinators, it's the norm. In a society overcrowded with victims, it is typical. It's not my fault. It's not my job. I've got news for you. You are your job. I'm not interested in helping you develop a list of intentions, nor do I care to provide you with interesting insights about your life that stops there with no associated action. I am interested in creating change in your life. To know why you are failing at any endeavor is half the challenge, but only half. I want to influence you in a way that gets you out of your typical behavior and excuses. That means you are going to have to measure yourself based on results. That means you don't take excuses from other people. If you decide that you will require better treatment from those with whom you live, then measure that treatment by measuring their actions, not their words. You cannot spend the rest of your life letting somebody else tell you how to feel or tell you that you just see things wrong. They need to either put up or shut up, and so do you. If this audiobook is going to be of any value, no matter what we're talking about, no matter what problem we're attacking or what issue we're addressing, you must commit to measuring yourself and everyone else on the basis of outcomes. Hard, but true. Only with results can we be sure that the changes are real. You know as well as I do that what I'm saying is the way it is. You may choose to ignore the truth, but that won't change it. You change things by doing. The time-honored formula for taking purposeful action goes like this. Be, do, have. What the formula says is, be committed, do what it takes, and you will have what you want. Life law number 5, life rewards action, talks about the do part of the formula. You can know 100-fold more today than you knew a week ago, but if you don't do anything about it, you aren't any more effective than you were last week in your unenlightened state. Until knowledge, awareness, insights, and understandings are translated into action, they are of no value. If a doctor knows why you are dying, yet does nothing about it, you are dead. If someone knows he is standing on your foot, yet does nothing about it, your foot is still smashed. If you know why your marriage is failing, yet you do nothing about it, the marriage still fails. Life rewards action, not intention, not insight, not wisdom, not understanding. The difference between winners and losers is that winners do things losers don't want to do. Notice the word do in that statement. People who win take purposeful, meaningful action. They don't just think about it. They don't plan themselves to death. They don't have a meeting to plan a meeting to set up a meeting to decide what to do. There comes a time when you have to pull the trigger. To have what you want, you have to do what it takes. I put this life law in this position on the list because you now know enough about yourself to begin to do. Now is the time, even before we have designed a specific life strategy for you, to begin doing some things differently. Life law number 1, you either get it or you don't, tells you that you must do what it takes to accumulate enough knowledge to get it. Life law number 2, you create your own experience, puts you on notice that when you choose the behavior, you choose the consequences. You need to start affirmatively choosing the right behaviors in order to get the right consequences. You've got to discipline your behavior toward having what you want. Life law number 3 says, people do what works. Do you need to change what you're doing so that you're getting healthy results instead of unhealthy ones? If you change what you do, and you change the payoffs you get, you are moving in the right direction. Nothing in your life will change until you begin to do different things. The question you may need to ask yourself is, if not now, when? Pull the trigger. Get up off your knowledge and do something different with your life. Lives move by trends and momentum. If you begin to do things different, whether that means exercising, giving your feelings a voice, going back to school, praying, or applying for a new job, your actions will gain momentum. You'll meet new people. New possibilities will occur to you. Soon enough, you'll discover that your life is no longer the same song, 7,000th verse. You'll realize that those old sayings have long lives because they're true. You can't get a hit if you're not swinging. You can't catch a fish if you don't put your hook in the water. This law is about getting you to swing the bat or cast your line. It's about putting some verbs in your sentences and action in your life. If you're like a lot of people, one of the things you need to take action on is catching up emotionally with someone you love. Wouldn't it be tragic if you or they ran out of time before you overcame the inertia of your life and said what you had in your heart? Don't cop out and say, "Well, I haven't said it, but they know." No. When you die or they die, it's forever. No second chances. If, for example, one of those people is your child, and God forbid you died today, you may have wished that you had said something like, "I love you. I am and always have been proud of you, even though I did not tell you very often, if ever. You are so very special. Please know every day of your life that you were loved by me. And now that I know that I am not long for this world, I am truly sorry that I did not spend more time knowing you, being with you, and letting you know me. You are a good man and a good father. The world is blessed by you. Please be happy and well, and live and love in your life. And know that there was someone in this world who recognized your specialness, who believed in you and loved you. Be kind to you for me. If I die tonight, I will be at peace knowing that you knew what was in my heart." Perhaps these words, spoken to me by my father shortly before his untimely death, can help you begin to give a voice to feelings that you have that, unspoken, without the critical ingredient of action, are of no importance. By contrast, those same feelings, expressed in a heartfelt way, are to be treasured forever. Take the action to create your own experience. I must tell you that had my father not spoken these words to me, I would not have just known. I needed to hear those words. So do the people in your life. That's not all I gleaned from that last encounter with my dad. I too made it a point to speak from my heart, and knowing that nothing had been left unsaid was very comforting to me when he died. At one point I asked him how he felt physically. His answer was so typically Dr. Joe, as he was known. He said, "Well, I wouldn't buy me any green bananas, I can tell you that. And by the way, I went to a funeral last week, and the preacher was saying that this was a passing to a better life and that we should rejoice. Well, that's bull. I want everybody at my funeral crying, or I'm coming back and causing big trouble." It was clear that he had made his peace and was going to have some fun on the way out. He faced the truth, and he dealt with it with dignity and respect. My dad's life was a lesson about action. At the age of 71, 30 years after earning his Ph.D. in psychology, he enrolled in the seminary with the intention of earning a Master of Divinity degree. The problem was exhaustion. His heart was so bad he could only walk 50 feet at a time, so he had to get to campus 30 minutes before class. Then, from the parking lot, he had mapped out a route as complicated as any pass pattern in the NFL. 50 steps to the park bench and rest. 37 steps to the tree stump and rest. And so on every day, all just to go 150 yards. But he saw it through. Ultimately, after 2 years, and I don't know how many rest stops, my dad stepped on to the dais to receive his diploma, and the whole arena erupted in cheers. So don't tell me about how hard it is to do things. If you've been cheating yourself in life, it's quite possible that you're in pain. Believe it or not, that may now actually be a good thing, something that you can use to your benefit. Pain, if acknowledged, can be a powerful motivator. Whatever pain is present in your life right now may serve as the fuel in your quest for change. I grew up in Texas where, like most kids in the summer, I used to run around barefoot. There's probably not a person alive who hasn't had the experience I remember so well. You run out on the blacktop road barefoot, and when you're about halfway across, it hits you. Yikes, my feet are melting. Now, at that point, you're going to do something. You might go backward, you might go forward, but you aren't just going to stand there waiting for your feet to burst into flames and melt up to your ankles. You will not stand in the middle of the road. You're going to move one way or the other. Pain gets you to take a direction. Use it to propel yourself out of the situation you are in and get you where you want to be. The same pain that burdens you now could be turned to your advantage. It may be the very motivation you need to change your life. Some people just seem to be natural risk takers. They keep on reaching, they keep on doing until they get what they've wanted and dreamed about. They have a mindset that accepts risk as a way of life. They are unwilling to settle for the bird in the hand if it is not the right bird. Other people, however, scramble for safety or withdraw from the game when things start to look scary or unknown or hard. These people settle for what they don't want and for a very logical, if unproductive, reason. By settling, they remove themselves from the stress, pressure, and fear of reaching and possibly failing. By taking a seat in the comfort zone, they avoid the risk of failing and the pain that goes with it. If you pretend that what you have is okay, and you rationalize why you don't want or deserve more, there is no fear or risk of failure. You take what you've got and play it safe. Comfort zones mean no stretching, no changing, no risking a journey into uncharted waters. The catch-22 is this. If you continue to reach and do new things, the fear can become so debilitating that you stop and become inert. If you pull out before you start, you never even reach. Risk simply means that something of value is put in jeopardy. In most cases, that something is, at a minimum, your peace of mind, your lifestyle, your relationships, or maybe your financial stability. The very act of admitting that you want more puts the balance of your existence in jeopardy. You feel a tension between wanting to maintain the security of sameness, however mundane and boring it may be, and the hope and excitement of having what you really want. No matter what the circumstances of your life may be, even if it is painful, disrupting the sameness can be scary. A familiar pain is like a not very good old friend. It's not a good friend, but it's an old friend. It is predictable. You know how bad it gets, and you know where the bottom is. These things aren't true of new risk. We fear the unknown, and when we try something new, the results are always in question. How bad can this get? Can I lose it all? Will I fail? So goes the logic of avoidance. No pressure, no pain, no fear. Just don't do it, and the problem goes away. You know you've done this a million times. Remember when you wanted that special date in school, but you didn't ask for it? You didn't get the date you wanted, but the anxiety went away, and you were safe again. We've all made such choices. Call it a cop-out, call it choking, or call it selling out your dreams. But in any event, you quit on yourself and your life before you got what you wanted. Life doesn't reward quitting. You're the only one that has ever done that. And you may reward yourself for quitting with a pseudo-peace, a peace that comes at the price of your hopes and dreams. People talk so much these days about fear that it has become, to my way of thinking, a too convenient excuse to just sit on the sidelines and not take action. You have to put your worries aside. When it comes to taking action in the face of fear, it probably doesn't require much reflection to know that you've done this kind of thing before. You took a chance when you went from crawling to walking, when you went from one grade in school to the next, when you swam for the first time, when you moved away from home, when you changed jobs or quit or moved to a new job in a new town, when you asked for that date. In each of these situations, you left behind the non-threatening sameness of your life to reach for something more. Most of this kind of reaching is a good thing, since it is what broadens your horizons and allows you to develop your own competency and worldliness. Think, for example, about what your life and career would be like if you had never gone from crawling to walking. The point is that whatever your habit and your pattern may be, you must recognize that you no longer need to live your life in that way. However illogical it may seem, you must decide that you are worth the risk. You must decide that your dreams are not to be sold out. You must decide that you, for one, are willing to let yourself want, let yourself reach, let yourself admit that you are living a sold-out existence. You must be willing to say, I know it may hurt for a while, I know it may be scary for a while, but I am worth it. I'm going to stop denying myself even the chance of getting my goals and dreams. I'm going to set goals, make a strategy, and take action. Consider that in the interest of incorporating the law, life rewards action, into your own life, you may need to make a decision to actually put yourself at risk, even though this goes against your primal instinct for self-preservation. It challenges your natural craving for safety and security. But I suspect that this is one of those times when you simply must call upon yourself to leave behind the comfortable and familiar. Decide that you're going to move onward and upward. Make a life decision to risk reasonably, risk responsibly, but risk. I'm not talking about skydiving here. I'm talking about letting yourself want more and taking the action to get it. Life Law Number 6. There is no reality, only perception. Your strategy? Identify the filters through which you view the world. Acknowledge your history without being controlled by it. This is a law so profound that it determines whether or not you are happy, satisfied, and at peace. Accepting this law means that you embrace the fact that no matter what happens in your life, how you interpret that event is up to you. Whatever meaning or value a particular circumstance has for you will be the meaning or value that you give it. To appreciate how this law works, you need to understand the difference between sensation and perception. When light waves are received by your eyes, or sound waves by your ears, that is sensation, the phenomenon of stimuli being received by your sense organs. Perception, on the other hand, is your organizing and interpreting of those sensations. Perception is the level at which you assign meaning to the sensations you receive from the world. The observation that beauty is in the eye of the beholder recognizes that your perceptions may be vastly different from mine. Both of us can look at the same picture, and I might like it while you might not. The same holds true with each and every event in your life. We can't talk about what happens in your life without taking into account your interpretations of what happens. Because you are a unique individual, your perceptions are unique. No matter how much you think you are like another person, The meanings you assign to what takes place in your life are yours alone. The failure to recognize this principle has created more trouble than you could ever imagine. We now know, for example, that in addition to the differences from one individual to the next in terms of perception and interpretation, there are also gender differences that distinguish the perceptions of men and women. Married couples have for centuries been plagued by this phenomenon. It's no secret that a husband and wife, looking at the same situation, can come up with two totally different versions of what it means. This incongruency of perceptions can lead to frustration, confusion, and marital disharmony. Specifically, having tested this theory with literally thousands of couples over the years, I have found that women think of even mundane chores very differently than do men. There are wide disparities in how the partners interpret something as simple as taking out the garbage. Men tend to categorize taking out the trash as a duty. Most women, on the other hand, interpret it as an act of love. Women have explained their thinking to me in this way. Taking out the garbage is a distasteful job, and if he loved me, he would do it so I would not have to. If he doesn't do those things that he knows increase the quality of my life, then he must not care about the quality of my life, and therefore I conclude that he does not love me. By contrast, men perceive taking out the garbage as merely one of many duties they have to perform in a given day. Their perception of it is such that if they are unable to get around to it that day, they will just add it to the list for the next day. It never occurs to men that since the women in their lives see doing this chore as an act of love, their failure to do it will be viewed as unloving. There's absolutely nothing to be gained by asking who is right and who is wrong in this scenario. Neither spouse is right or wrong. There is no reality, only perception. If she interprets the failure to perform this task as an indication of not being loved, then that interpretation is as real to her as the sun coming up in the morning. If he interprets it as simply another of the day's jobs, having absolutely no emotional meaning attached to it, then that is his perception, just as real to him as hers is to her. How you view the event is what determines its meaning to you. The key point is that where your perceptions are concerned, you have the ability to choose differently from what you are currently choosing, if you wish. When it comes to how you see things, you do have a choice. Put another way, there is no good news and there is no bad news. There is only news. You have the power to choose your perceptions, and you exercise this power of choice in every circumstance, every day of your life. When you consider the relevance of this observation to your own life, in fact to everyone's life, I believe you'll appreciate why I think it is such a profound truth. Think about it. When you pick up the newspaper and the headline says, "Democrats win control of Senate," is that good news or bad news? In fact, it's neither. It's just news. It is not good or bad until you assign a meaning to it. If you yourself are a Democrat and are comfortable with what the Democrats are doing politically, then it may be good news. If you're a Republican who is not at all comfortable with what they are doing, then it is decidedly bad news. The crucial thing to notice is that your response to the headline is not a function of what happened, but instead is a function of how you choose to perceive what happened. I'm not suggesting that one of your choices is to decide that anything that may happen in your life is a good deal. Obviously, that is not always a rational reaction. Should some injury or tragedy befall one of your children or a loved one, it is not rational for you to perceive that in some way that is a good thing. But you do have a choice about whether that event will be your absolute undoing or whether it becomes something you deal with in a constructive manner. If, for example, one of your children is injured, you may choose to learn from that event and thereby protect him or her and your other children more effectively in the future. You may choose to see that the child learns to deal with and overcome adversity. You may choose to teach that health and well-being are not to be taken for granted. You may decide to take steps to change the situation in which the injury took place, thereby protecting other children. Everywhere you look, you see examples of exactly this kind of creating value from adversity. Mothers Against Drunk Drivers is a wonderful organization and a perfect example of how parents who have suffered the loss or injury of a child at the hands of an irresponsible element of society have chosen, through social action, to create meaning out of that suffering. Please don't think for a minute that I am suggesting that a single one of those parents would consider his or her social action worth the injury or death of their child. I am only pointing out that their reaction to the fact that it did happen was a choice, and that they chose a constructive alternative. You do have a choice about how you perceive the world. It is important that you realize that we all view the world through individual filters. Those filters, our personalities, attitudes, points of view, our styles, powerfully influence the interpretations that we give to the events in our lives. Those interpretations, in turn, determine how we will respond and therefore how we will ultimately be responded to. The presence of these filters is neither good nor bad. It just is. Some filters may be healthy and constructive, while others may be distorted and destructive. But to live effectively, you've got to recognize the presence of your filters and take care that they don't distort your perceptions so as to mislead you in your decision-making. There's no question that the filters through which we view the world are a byproduct of our learning history. Someone who tragically has been raised in a hostile and violent setting is likely to process his experiences through a filter that causes him to interpret the world as a threatening place. By contrast, a person whose upbringing was loving, caring, and nurturing will very likely view the world through a filter that causes him or her to interpret it as wonderful. But what you need to recognize is that it doesn't have to matter in the here and now whether your past has been good or bad, just that it has been. I won't debate with you whether the cards you were dealt were good or bad, whether you got a fair deal or an unfair deal, got treated right or not. Suppose for a moment that we're in the counseling setting. Certainly, I want to know what your history is. More importantly, I want you to know that history. I want you to recognize that if you were raped or beaten when you were 5 years old, that episode may have understandably distorted your view of relationships. If you continue to view the world through a filter created by past events, then you are allowing your past to control and dictate both your present and your future. Take the example of someone who was raped and beaten at the age of 5. The only thing worse than the event itself would be allowing that terrible event to destroy that person's entire life by coloring how they see the world 30, 40, or 50 years later. In that scenario, the event never comes to an end. It lives forever. As you have already learned, you cannot change what you do not acknowledge. Once you acknowledge that the pain of a particular event has altered the way you view the world and the people in it, then you can choose to be no longer a prisoner of those perceptions. If you are not now asking yourself, what are the filters through which you view the world? You should be. Identify those filters so you can compensate for them. Do you have a chip on your shoulder? Do you see people in general as the enemy when they are not? Do you resent members of the opposite sex? are you incredibly naive and blindly trusting? Whatever your filter is, you need to know it. Unfortunately, our filters are never more profoundly distorted than when we view ourselves. As a matter of course, people simply do not see themselves in a realistic and objective light. We completely overlook the ways in which we ourselves contribute to our experience of the world. Think about how many times you've heard people narrate an incident in their lives without seeming to notice any of their own accountability for what happened. You hear them blame other people involved, often in excruciating detail, and charge right past what is obvious to everyone listening, namely their own contribution to the incident. I work with a brilliant and sophisticated trial analyst, whose name it would be indiscreet to reveal, Lyndon McLennan. Some years ago, at the age of 40, Lyndon had just moved and was staying temporarily in an apartment. As I walked past Lyndon's office one Monday morning, I overheard him telling colleagues about what had happened in the neighborhood laundromat over the weekend. It seems another patron, a man probably in his 20s, entered the laundromat and, without asking, removed Lyndon's clothes from a dryer, piled them on a table, and then put his own clothes in the dryer. Lyndon had stepped out for a moment, but returned during this apparently heinous transgression against his clothes. As Lyndon told us about the deed, it was clear that he was still appalled. Now, I admit to being a little unclear about laundromat protocol, but I did not yet grasp the direction of this story. Lyndon said he confronted the man for his insolence, and an argument ensued. In a matter of seconds, the conversation apparently kind of dried up, because Lyndon and the stranger now wrestled each other to the ground and rolled under a table, where Lyndon wound up on top of the young man, choking him. The next part of the story Lyndon told with great passion. While sitting on top of this young man, his knee in the man's chest, both hands around his throat, Lyndon yelled, "If you will grow up and act your age, I will let you up." The story ended with Lyndon asking us if we could believe how childish and immature this young man had been. Now, it occurred to me that a 40-year-old man who was wrestling someone under a table in a laundromat in a dispute over a dryer might have been acting a little less than mature himself. And I said so. The blank look with which Lyndon greeted this suggestion told us that it had never occurred to him that he was being immature. He was totally oblivious to his role in the incident and was clearly shocked when everybody in the room began howling with laughter. His nickname since then has been Laundromat. He may eventually live this down, but not if I have anything to do with it. The point is that it was almost impossible for Lyndon to be objective about his own role in what happened, to see his own behavior in a clear and rational light. How about you? One of the greatest difficulties with filters, whether they pertain to your perception of yourself or of others, is that they are made up of fixed beliefs. A fixed belief can be thought of as a life decision gone bad. It's a negative belief so entrenched in your thinking as to be a fixed part of your perceptual system. Fixed beliefs are typically very dangerous, if for no other reason than their fixedness. Consciously or otherwise, you have stopped seeking or receiving and processing new information. You're treating the belief as fact.